Now stay tuned for the Sunday Morning Wake Up Call on 97.9 The Wren. The Wake Up Call talks with the people in Charlottesville and Albemarle County who are making a difference. Now here's your host, Rick Moore. I'm Dan Gould, sitting in for Rick Moore. Rick returns next Sunday. It's been quite a year for all of us here at The Wake Up Call. In June, we moved to our new home here at Real Oldies 97.9 The Wren. As our studios were closed due to COVID-19, we began producing our shows remotely and have done so ever since. Hopefully, we'll find our way back to our studio at The Wren in the new year. We're closing off our 2020 season here at The Wake Up Call with three stories from earlier this year. Later in this hour, you'll hear portions of our interview with Doris Gelbman of Gelbman Law and Beth Norton from Norton Health Law about the role of the law in protecting elder health. Also later in the program, we'll take another listen to our interview with Albemarle Charlottesville Regional Jail Superintendent Colonel Martin Coomer about crime, rehabilitation, and the jail. But first, from September, Sunday Morning Wake Up Call host Rick Moore talked with writer, journalist, editor, and filmmaker Sierra Bellows about the University of Virginia's 1970 transition from an all-male institution to co-ed. Here's Rick Moore.
And good morning, everyone. Thank you for being here with us. Sunday Morning Wake Up Call. We always like to be here on Sundays. Our guest today, Sierra Bellows. She's a writer, a journalist, an editor, a filmmaker. Ms. Bellows' work has been published at our local Seaville Weekly, all the way to the New York Times. She was an editor at Virginia Magazine. She taught fiction in U.S. colleges, and she's a filmmaker on different continents. Ms. Bellows also won a 2016 grant for her novel. Welcome, Sierra Bellows.
Thanks for having me.
Well, our show today, an article that you were a part of, you were a writer and an editor, History of Women at UVA. And it just seemed so pertinent. We couldn't skip a show on this. Because in 2020, 50 years after UVA goes fully co-ed, correct?
Yeah. So back in 1970 was the first class of undergrads where women were admitted. And it's also 100 years since women were allowed to go to school at UVA in the graduate schools. So in 1920, women got the vote in the U.S., and they also could go to graduate school at UVA, the law school, the med school, other graduate programs. Women have been part of the university since the beginning, of course. Although Jefferson thought that a good education was the bedrock of democracy, he did not extend a higher education in his plan for women, for the university. But then there have been women working at the school, living on grounds and also doing, you know, like summer classes for a long time. And then in 1969, there was a court case and UVA was sued. The name of the woman who, Ms. Scott, I think, was the person who brought a lawsuit against UVA. And it was a class action lawsuit representing any woman who wanted to apply and said, you know, you should really allow women to study as undergrads. And the ACLU helped with the case. And then the school actually settled before there was a a court decision on it and decided to allow women to start attending as regular undergrads in the fall of 1970.
So I have it here that the court case, one of the things I found interesting about this court case, ACL lawsuit, that the lawyer for the women trying to get into UVA was actually a male University of Virginia graduate.
Yeah, John Lowe. He graduated from the law school in 67. And he was a young lawyer in 69. And Ms. Scott met him because she applied to work at his law office. So she had been going to another Virginia school, but she was from Charlottesville. She went to Albemarle High School. And then when her mom died, she could no longer go to school away, and she moved back to Charlottesville. And she got a job at this law office and was talking to John Lowe and explaining how she wanted to continue her education, but she couldn't do it in Charlottesville because UVA didn't allow women as undergrads. And I guess John Lowe didn't know that. He was shocked and appalled. But yeah, he ended up representing Ms. Scott and three other women in the class action suit. And then he went on to have an amazing career doing a lot of civil rights work.
I just found it, you know, I think I told you this before we got started. My mother went to school here in 1966. 67 in the education school. But during this time, during when the school goes co-ed, there were 400. I'm looking now at the article. There were just a few students that were let in September of 1970, 450 undergraduate women were allowed, 350 who were first years.
One of the big concerns, I think, for the university about going co-ed was they didn't want to prevent male students from getting into the university because their spots had been, you know, taken by women. And so in 1970, yeah, it was, I think, 450. And then I think in 71, it was 550 female students. I think that before that year, because there were women in the nursing school and also in the education school, I have 18% in my head for some reason, but there was a percentage of students, but there's not undergraduate students. You could also, I think, before 1970, if you were a third or a fourth year student at like Mary Wash, and you had, you know, were doing well academically, you could also transfer to UVA. When they let women in 70, there was a lot of concern about where they would live, like the dorms for them and the bathrooms. And indeed, during the court case in 69, there was a question of, you know, like how will they, what bathrooms will they have? Like, how will we transform male bathrooms into bathrooms that women can use. And one of the person who was on the stand said, well, we could put flowers in the urinals, and that will make them female bathrooms. And I heard, and there's actually photographic evidence that back in 1971, women did put flowers in the urinals of several bathrooms on ground.
Our guest today is Sierra Bellows, and she's with us talking about one of her articles, History of Women at UVA. It's 50 years now since University of Virginia finally went fully co-ed, and there's a lot happened before 1970, and a lot has happened since. It took a couple years, and in 1972, the first female law resident, but it only took 10 years before was the first year that the number of women at the school exceeded the number of men.
1980, when women were on par with men at the university. If you look at the entire university, not just undergrads, and then in 1995, women at the university more women at the university in 1995, and every year since, there are more female students, but by a tiny margin. But that's continued to be the case. Although it's also the case at most universities in North America. I remember when I was looking at undergrad schools when I was younger, I was looking at schools in Canada, and there was only one school that had more men than women, and it was the University of Waterloo. And I considered it. I thought, well, you know, maybe that would be cool. But I didn't end up going there.
Let's go further back in time, pre-1970, the early years, and there was something called the normal school. Can you tell us about that?
So normal school started in 1880, and it was training for school teachers. And so that first year, 312 of those students were women of the 500. But women, they didn't get university credits for going to the normal school. Men did, but women just got a certificate that could, you know, help them with their careers as school teachers, but they weren't given the same kind of accreditation as men were given, even though they were doing exactly the same coursework, which is weird. There was a lot kind of going on in the summers for women at the school. There was also, you could take classes in home economics and cooking. Stock judging, which is something to do with looking at, you know, cows and maybe other farm animals to figure out which ones you should breed. When I was working on this article, and actually at my time at Virginia Magazine, I would go through the photo archives at UVA a lot. It was one of my favorite things to do. Because there's just these amazing photographs of students and professors and performances at the school, the secret societies, like these beautiful images. And for this article, I found one, and it's an instructor at a summer school teaching stock judging. And so it's this man with a cow, and then there is all these women students in their very formal clothes and their hair up and they're all holding pencils and taking notes as they watch the instructor teach them something about this cow. I don't know.
So at the normal school, they were being taught stock judging and teaching and nursing, and the article mentions home economics and cooking. What other jobs were available in the world at the time, or in the United States at the time?
I mean, actually at the university at that time, a lot of the administrative and secretarial work was being done by women, even then. My grandmother was a nurse, and then she became a school librarian, and I feel like she did the two main careers that women had open to them at the time. Because teachers and nurses, that was the way for a lot of women to have careers. At the nursing school at UVA, you couldn't get married while you were a student. You'd have to leave the school if you got married, which I thought was wild. That's no longer true, though. Now you're allowed to get married whenever you want.
I read that in 1894, an attempt was made to allow there was a vote about women being at the university, and a vote was taken. Can you talk about that, by Addis Mead and the faculty?
I don't remember a lot about that, except for that it was the Board of Visitors just decided no. that wasn't not something that they wanted to do. And there was a lot of talk about maintaining the culture of the university and the idea that UVA had a singular culture that was, born out of being Jefferson's idea and being a gentleman's university of the South. So there was an idea that tradition mattered more than anything else.
Well, then let's move to 1920, when the General Assembly decided to allow women to graduate and professional programs. What was the change then?
I think that it was just things were already changing for women. 1920, they got the vote. I think that the women were coming into positions of greater power culturally. Although in 1920, when the university opened up grad schools to women, only 23 enrolled. So they were still only 1% of the total population of students at the school.
Our guest today is Sierra Bellows, a writer, a journalist, an editor, a filmmaker, and as we talk about the history of women at UVA, we are 50 years later since UVA finally went fully co-ed.
You're listening to the Sunday Morning Wake-Up Call on Real Oldies 97.9 The Wren. After the break, Doris Geldman of Geldman Law and Beth Norton from Norton Health Law talk about the role of the law in protecting elder health. Please stay with us. Also from September, Doris Geldman from Geldman Law and Beth Norton from Norton Health Law joined us to talk about the role of law in protecting elder health. Once again, here's Rick Moore.
Our guests today, Beth Norton from Norton Health Law and Doris Gelman from Gelman Law. You can find them in Charlottesville. Ladies, I started talking about the healthcare facility in Harrisonburg and the fact that there were some issues about the state inspection reports and some of the choices that were being made there in early April after the COVID-19 virus had become quite apparent in senior care facilities and in just the regular household. Can you talk for a moment about nursing home inspections being sharply curtailed after the pandemic starts? One of the bits of information in this article was that this company, part of which was this Harrisonburg facility, it suffered severe COVID-19 outbreaks and staffing shortages, according to state inspection reports. And we'll get into other articles about how, because of the way things are going with loss of staff throughout the state, people not being sent into buildings, not all the inspections are being done.
So I'm going to back you up just a little bit on this because I want to preface everything I'm going to say by at least one statement I'm pretty sure Beth will back me up on. I think it's really, really important that people understand that I have nothing but 100% support for the people who are providing care in these facilities. The CNAs, the nurses, the med techs, even the environmental and dietary people, they have worked their hearts out. They are devastated by these occurrences, and it is no fault of theirs that any of this is Absolutely. Happening. So I want to make that very, very clear. And, you know, we as not even as providers, we are very supportive of the community that is caring for these people night and day, you know, working 12, 15, 24-hour-a-day shifts. Really fighting for people's lives, and we support them in every way possible. As far as the inspections go, I think you have to wind the clock back a little bit and understand, and specifically in the article that you're referring to, the violations that are reported in there are before the COVID crisis happened. And this is a problem throughout the nursing home system and assisted living system, but we're mostly focusing on nursing homes. And the staff shortages are not a result of the COVID crisis. The COVID crisis is a result of the pre-existing conditions in the nursing homes. This was a petri dish waiting for this virus to drop into it. It was ripe for this outbreak. They've had outbreaks of norovirus before. They've had outbreaks of flu before. They lose patients every year to various outbreaks and infections, MRSA infections, you name it, they get it. And the staff shortages are not a result of the illnesses. They're a result of wanting to make a profit on the backs of the suffering of the people that live in these places. The people who own the nursing homes, in order to make a profit, short-staff them in order to save the money on staffing. So along comes this infection, and it gets a foothold or a toehold even in these facilities, and there are not enough people to take care of the people that get sick. Then the staff themselves get sick, and many of them are. Trust me, there have been people that have died, doctors, nurses, aides, and many of them quit because they were frightened of taking this thing home with them. So there was indeed an even greater shortage, but there has always been a problem with staff shortage. So that needs to be very, very clear, that it's the cause of the outbreak, not the result of.
Beth, am I hearing that there's an issue here between patient care and profit.
Oh, absolutely. Like Doris said, that's always been the case. I worked in it. I lived it. And when I was defending facilities in my medical malpractice defense practice, it was the number one cause of every lawsuit that I was defending these facilities from against. And there were any number of issues that were secondary to this problem. For example, we had a lot of cases that involved patient falls because there was inadequate staff to help the people who are unable to, for example, get up to use the bathroom by themselves or, to ambulate by themselves. You had falls, you had cases of bed sores and just general neglect. It caused any number of issues. And then, of course, when you have an outbreak like this, it just compounds the issue, and one feeds into the other, and you end up in a deadly cycle where now the short staffing contributes to the COVID problem, contributes to the short staffing, and eventually you just end up with a disaster, which is what we've seen and what Doris has really brought a lot of attention to. Including in this article. So yes, it was something that I've experienced both from the clinical perspective and from, in my own practice, in the liability of these facilities. One of the things that I think, what Dora said was really important to note is that the staff themselves are victims of this as well. Staff burnout is, it's an inevitable reality in nursing and particularly in CNAs and again, particularly in these long-term care facilities. You come to work and you've got 30 patients, as an aide. That's not unusual to be responsible for keeping people, appropriately turned, because if you're not, if patients aren't turned, they get bed sores, and keeping them, clean, their hygiene. They're responsible for so much, and it causes so much stress and burnout. So it's really, both the patients and the staff themselves are the victims here. And I always made a, point of when I was defending these cases, of making sure that there was a distinction between, you would have a plaintiff's attorney talking about, the substandard care that these nurses were providing, and it was like, wait a minute, you have to take into account. And of course, I couldn't point out how short-staffed the facility was, because then I'm admitting liability as a as an attorney, but it was a reality, and I was always very, very protective of my nurses when they were, in depositions or on the stand, that they weren't treated like the villains here. They are truly victims of this as well.
That's Beth Norton from Norton Health Law. We also have Doris Gelman from Gelman Law as we talk about health and elder law in 2020. I'm curious, ladies, when and why did we switch from care to profit at these facilities? Who wants to take on that question first?
Well, I have to wipe the saliva off of my chin because I just can't wait to get into that subject. So Beth, I hope will forgive me for leading off. It is a real bone of contention, for people who are in this business. First of all, I think it's really important to note that medical nursing facilities, as we know them today, are a relatively new phenomenon. For historically, it really wasn't until like the 1940s that we began to house people in quote unquote nursing homes. Typically, people were taken care of by their families in their homes until the day they died. And there's two reasons for that. One, that was just the way it was. Families took care of their families. And the other reason was people did not live long extended lives with this long period of health decline, we keep people alive artificially and perhaps too long, which is why they end up needing a facility like this to take care of them. We also keep them in ICU and cardiac units and hospitalized way longer.
Yeah, so like Doris said, you know, historically we took care of our elderly family members until they died. And there are a lot of reasons why that changed. I mean, you know, not to throw women under the bus, because I'm certainly a working woman myself, but, you know, it used to be that women were at home taking care of the children, so they would also take care of their family members. So that definitely changed. And I don't know, and maybe Doris can speak to this better than I can, but I think profit has probably been an issue. At least when the switch was made between charitable organizations were operating a lot of these nursing facilities a long time ago. And again, I think Doris can probably speak better to the history of that. But, you know, like the Catholic Church and a good number of healthcare facilities, including nursing facilities. And of course, they run, you know, they're nonprofits. And again, Doris, I think you can probably speak better to when that shift occurred, I think probably in the 70s or 80s, that that we made the move from these nonprofit organizations and a lot of religious organizations to then these for-profit companies.
Absolutely, absolutely. Some of them are still around. You know, for here locally, for example, Our Lady of Peace is still owned by the Catholic Diocese, I think out of Richmond, and Westminster Canterbury is owned by some ecumenical, some church-affiliated Church of the Brethren or somebody like that. I can't remember. So they're nonprofits, and they provide very good care. There's also government organizations. For many, many years, veterans have been cared for in you know, retired service people's nursing homes, those sorts of things. And that's been around for a long, long time. What I was getting ready to say, though, in terms of the way people died back, you know, for most of our history, people died at a much earlier age. If you look at the early part of the 20th century, just as recently as like the 1920s, people did not live beyond 50, 60 years old on average. And what happened is you're at home, you get the flu, you get some sort of infectious disease, TB, pneumonia, the flu, something like that. And 3 days later, you're dead, right? You did not linger in care for a long period of time. And so that's what happened. And so when we started following the Second World War, when we started building these, what's known as a medical model of nursing care, which is what we have today, one of the things that happened very quickly was the difficulty in paying for care for a long period of time. And that's where Roosevelt and subsequent governments stepped in, and they created Social Security, and they created Medicaid, and they created all these ways to pay for people as they aged. The other place that this grew out of historically was poorhouses, right? We would sentence people to poorhouses, and they would grow old there, workhouses and poorhouses. So, you know, we have a long history of housing people in that way. So Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid were all put in place to take people out of poverty and to care for them as they age. Of course, they could no longer work. So that's where that came from. And that also would contributed to the idea, well, how are we, the providers, going to make money because the government is telling us how much we're going to make? And there's this very, very complicated mix of how they admit patients, how many Medicaid patients they're going to take, how many Medicare patients. Those are people who are receiving rehabilitation, physical therapy, occupational therapy, speech therapy, and they're there only for a short period of time. The government reimburses at a much higher rate for what's known as skilled care as opposed to long-term care, which is paid for by Medicaid or privately.
Here's a question for you. So, again, our guest, Doris Gelman, Gelman Law, Beth Norton, Norton Health Law. So we talk about these questions. who is making the money? Because as I mentioned at the start of the program, there's a facility in Harrisonburg who was in this article, 75 facilities. The one in Harrisonburg, just one that received a single star rating, doing things that people are going to frown at. And who is making this money? These are not independently owned people with the guy with the curly mustache standing on the side of the building, twirling it, trying to trick people to come inside.
That's Snidely Whiplash is his name. He is standing out there, but he is nowhere near the building. Mostly they're in California or New Jersey or someplace like that.
And he's got friends now.
Yes, he has friends, and they're called venture capitalists. And for the most part, these nursing homes are parts of large chains of nursing homes. You have very rare to have a small independent or family-owned nursing home, or even a chain of nursing homes. They are owned by a distant venture capital group, private. It is not traded publicly. There is no information available about them. There's no, they're not traded on the stock market, so there's no reporting that's done. There's no regulation of how much money they can make. And the money is paid out to the other shareholders in this thing. And it's generally a very small circle of people. And what they do, and this is a relatively recent occurrence, is what happened is they began buying up failing nursing homes. And what they do is they create a shell game. So you have this venture capital company, Snidely Whiplash Venture Capitalists. And those folks go out and they create something called an LLC, a limited liability corporation, or an REIT, which stands for Real Estate Investment Trust. And so it's a shell game. They have all these little entities set up, and that's who technically operates the nursing home.
You've been listening to Doris Gelbman of Gelbman Law and Beth Norton from Norton Health Law talking about the role of law in protecting elder health. On this, our season finale, we're taking a look back at three shows from 2020. You're listening to the Sunday Morning Wake-Up Call on Real Oldies 97.9 The Wren. Stream us live at 979WREN.org or on your mobile device via TuneIn. I'm Dan Gould, sitting in for Rick Moore. After the break, a look back at our conversation with Albemarle Charlottesville Regional Jail Superintendent Colonel Martin Coomer about crime, rehabilitation, and the jail. Please stay with us. In August, Albemarle Charlottesville Regional Jail Superintendent Colonel Martin Coomer joined us to talk about crime, rehabilitation, and the jail. Again, Sunday Morning Wake-Up Call host Rick Moore.
Today, our guest, Superintendent of the Albemarle Charlottesville Regional Jail, Colonel Martin Coomer. Colonel, thank you so much for joining us.
No, you're welcome, Rick. Thanks for having me.
Now, this is your second visit to Sunday Morning Wake-Up Call, your first visit here on the Wren. So let's talk a little bit about you and how you got to your role and a little bit about the jail itself for those who aren't familiar.
Sure.
I'm always curious how a colonel gets to run the jail. Discuss your position of being a colonel.
All right, sure. As being the colonel and the superintendent of the jail, it's similar to a warden if it were a prison, and similar to a sheriff if it were a sheriff-run jail. Virginia is kind of unique that we have what are called regional jails, and we were, I believe, the first state in the United States to have regional jails. A regional jail is any jail that serves more than one community, such as a city or a county or two counties or two cities. And so I've been there now going on 21 years, 22 years, I believe. I started out in corrections in the Marine Corps as a corrections specialist. I was there for 4 years, enjoyed it, got out of the Marine Corps, started working at the regional jail here in Charlottesville, thought that one day I'd become a state trooper here in Virginia, and 21 years later, I am the superintendent. I've worked just about every department that the jail has to offer, gained some experience, worked in education while I was working at the jail, finished my associate's degree out there at Piedmont in criminal justice. Then I went on to Virginia VCU to finish my history degree of all things. And then I studied at the University of Richmond for a while. And then in 2014, I became the deputy superintendent. And then in 2015, when my predecessor, Colonel Ronald Matthews, retired, the board promoted me to superintendent.
Is the title of colonel, does that come from your role in the Marines?
No, it's a, for lack of a better word, it's kind of an honorary title for all superintendents in the Commonwealth of Virginia. They all go by the title of colonel.
And what made you, what led you to take the path away from state trooper and into corrections in the jail system?
Sure. Well, let's see, I was about 5 years in working at the jail, and I got promoted into the classification department as a case manager, and I got to know a lot more about Albemarle County, the city of Charlottesville, Nelson County, how the social services ends of it works, the reentry aspect of it. I was able to help more offenders in that capacity. I came to enjoy the work a lot more, and kind of saw that there's a lot that we could do, we could have an impact. And I really just fell in love with corrections kind of all over again, and decided I wanted to make a career of it, kind of helping people. So it's, and I thought, what better way than to stay where I was and continue down that path? So here I am.
Again, our guest is Colonel Martin Coomer. He's the superintendent at the Albemarle Charlottesville Regional Jail. And Colonel, how big is the jail, and how old is the jail?
Well, we became a regional jail, and again, not only was Virginia one of the first states to use regional jails, we also, the Albemarle Charlottesville Regional Jail was one of the first regional jails in the state. And that was in the early to mid-70s when it opened, and that's when we, City of Charlottesville and Albemarle County closed down their two jails and opened the jail out there on Avon Street and combined the two. And then Nelson County came on board in the late 90s when they the sheriff-run jail down there, Lovingston, was shut down, and they joined us as well. So it's we've been in the same structure now since the mid-70s, and we've done four additions and or renovations during that time, one in the 80s, one in the mid-90s, and then one in the late 90s, which is the large expansion you see there from the interstate, that six-story building. Now, that was the most recent addition. It's been 20 years ago now. And our capacity, let's see, we're rated to hold 329 people. And we've been as high as 610, 615 several years ago. And
wow.
And now we're at our lowest population in well over 20 years. Today, when I left, inside of the jail, there were 307 people. That's the lowest that jail's been in over 20 years.
So you actually have it now that not every bed is filled.
That's right. We're actually under capacity for the first time, I believe, under capacity since the early 90s. We, you know, several years ago, we're well over 600. And to get your, well, I think your question was going to be right there, what do you put 600 people in a place that's only designed to hold 329? Well, 329 is design capacity. It's based on how many bathrooms you have, square footage per person, and so forth. It's not necessarily how many beds you have. So we had over 600 beds inside that facility. But to say it was crowded was an understatement. So during that time, when it was severely overcrowded, we commissioned a study to do a forecast to see where our population would be in 2019. And that study said, man, you guys need to start building now because you're going to have close to 1,000 people in that jail by 2019. Here we are, 2019, and it's the lowest population. It's half what the population does when that study was done, let alone 1,000. So it's just interesting how things have really turned around over the last 10 to 15 years.
So I want to go back and talk about the COVID-19 virus and how it affects the jail system. Because I think that a lot of people drop the word jail and prison loosely. And it's easy to think of how COVID virus is affecting the prison system, because that's what's in the news. But the jail system is much more transient, right? I'm reading this article in preparation of today's talk with you, and I run into this nice phrase, this nice description from the Marshall Project. It says, picture thousands of cruise ships jammed with guests, but short on hand sanitizer, protective gear, and medical care. Every week, a quarter of the passengers get off, are replaced with new people with the potential to either infect or be infected with the coronavirus. And that was their description as to the potential problem of and concern with the jail setup. I'm curious as to your talk about how you deal with this on a daily basis.
Yeah, well, you know, I hadn't heard it described that way, but that pretty much sums it up. And there is a difference between prisons and jails. And quite frankly, if I had to choose one or the other to be running during a COVID pandemic, I would much choose a prison over a jail. And the reason for that is state prisons have the ability to stop taking people. So the Department of Corrections can say, we're locking down, we're not taking any new intakes. Everyone who's coming from the local jails, you must stay there, and we're not taking anybody else. So you greatly reduce your risk of bringing in the infection. All you have to worry about is your staff. You can close off your volunteers. You can close down your programs. You're only responsible for screening your staff and making sure they stay healthy and don't bring the virus inside the facility. A regional jail, I got 8 bookings last night. 8 new people came into the jail last night from 6 o'clock at night to about 4 o'clock in the morning. All 8 of those people, I have no idea if they have COVID. I have no idea if they have been exposed or whom they've been living with, or, and sometimes they don't know who they've been exposed to. We have, sometimes we have a large homeless population here in Charlottesville, and a lot of times those guys will come into the jail, and they are a greater risk for exposure. We've also learned that a lot of our population doesn't have routine access to healthcare, so they may be experiencing symptoms but have no way to or have less ways to get those things checked or monitored. So we deal with a much higher risk than the general public does, especially prisons. So it is a lot tougher. Now, I also have my staff who go home. They're around other people. They have lines outside the jail, and they're coming in and out of work every single day. So we have 2 different entry points where that virus can come in. So we determined a long time ago that our goal is not to prevent the virus from coming. It's just unrealistic. It cannot be done. So it's not no use in, you know, acquiring supplies or trying to acquire enough supplies that you can acquire on a goal that's just not feasible. So my goal is to manage it when it does come in. And that means I want to make sure that if you, just because you get COVID, my goal is to make sure you don't wind up in a hospital and that no one it suffers any significant medical consequences because of contracting COVID. So several ways we do that is when a new person comes in, we take their temperature before they come inside the building. We screen them before they get inside the building. We use a CDC screening criteria to make sure that they haven't been around anybody who's been exposed or tested positive and so on and so forth. And then we classify them as low risk, medium risk, or high risk. High risk meaning you live with somebody who tested positive or someone who's symptomatic, or you yourself are symptomatic, or you yourself have recently tested positive. Or low risk, you have no symptoms and you weren't around anybody who was symptomatic or tested positive, so on and so forth. And then we quarantine you with whomever you came in that day with at the same classification level as you do. So we put all the low risk together who came in that day. We put you in a housing area, just you, and we quarantine you for 2 weeks. At the end of 2 weeks, we then reevaluate you. A nurse comes down, asks the same questions, checks your temperature, looks for symptoms. If none, then we move you down to another quarantine area where you sit for another 2 weeks with other people who've also been screened and taken out the initial quarantine blocks for another 2 weeks. So we're doing the best we can to, if a person gets through that net, we limit the exposure to a small number of individuals, and then we can kind of contain the spread. And that's, so far, it's worked pretty good.
How are you handling smart versus reckless decisions by the staff?
Well, education, there's only so much you can do. We're all human. In the very beginning, we were all really scared. I was too. I came home. I would take my shoes off outside in the garage, wash my hands in the laundry room sink coming in, maintain my distance from my children from this part, take a shower. We were really, really conscious. We weren't intermingling with friends or neighbors or family. We were kind of staying to ourselves. And I think most people were doing that. We weren't really out there and about. The longer this thing goes on, it's hard to maintain that level of due diligence, I guess. Now that things are back open again, people are going out to dinner, people feel more comfortable being around other people. We're not as diligent as we once were. So we understand that. And we just try and tell our staff, listen, you got to be smart about this. Don't be around people who are symptomatic. If you yourself aren't feeling well, notify your supervisor. Stay home. If you do develop symptoms, let us know. We will get you tested. You don't come back until your tests come back. And so far, that's worked pretty well. We've had five staff over the last 5 months who have contracted COVID. Four in the very, very onset, late March, early April. And then one here a few weeks ago as well.
Have you suspended visitations to the staff? We just got a few minutes here before our first break. If you've got a detailed answer, we can come back from our break. But have you suspended visitations?
In short answer, yes, we have. Yeah, it's one of the first things we did. Absolutely. And we take a lot of other steps at the very onset as well. And we can certainly discuss those after the break.
Yeah. Again, our guest today is Colonel Martin Coomer. He is the superintendent at the Albemarle Charlottesville Regional Jail. And we're talking about how in the world you try and keep things safe at the jail in the current world of the COVID-19 virus. Colonel, we were talking about how the COVID-19 virus is affecting things, and you mentioned how the visitations have been suspended, and that was one of the first things that happened. When you and I got together the first interview back about 2 years ago, you were telling me about a new project that was going on for families to get together and talk without even coming to the jail. Some sort of, it wasn't an iPad, but it was similar. Can you, how does that play into things, or does it?
They are tablets. People might refer to them as, an Apple product, but they are not. They're made by another vendor, but they are tablets. The visitation is relatively inexpensive. I think we've got it down to 25 cents for a 15-minute visit. I would have to double-check that for sure. But our rationale is that it would be cheaper than someone driving to the jail and then driving back home again. They can stay wherever they are. They can visit from a phone, any smart device, any internet-connected device. They can visit with somebody. So we hope that they will enjoy the efficiency of being able to visit just by any time, anywhere that they want. Always, you get 2 30-minute visits per week, per month. So it's not a lot of visitation opportunities, and that's more because of the visitation booths that we have. We have very few areas where people can visit. With these tablets and with video visitation will begin in the mornings around 8 o'clock, and we'll probably turn the system off about 10 o'clock at night, 7 days a week. So we will greatly expand visitation opportunities for all of our inmates and their families and friends.
You've been listening to our August interview with Albemarle Charlottesville Regional Jail Superintendent Colonel Martin Coomer, who talked about crime, rehabilitation, and the jail. And that's it for this week and this season. We'd like to send a thank you to the many guests who took time out of their busy schedules to appear on our show this year, and to our many faithful listeners who have stayed with us for over 20 years. We'd also like to give special thanks to the good people at 97.9 The Wren for providing this space for us. And we'll close with a reminder that this and every episode of The Wake Up Call is available on demand at sevillepodcast.com. Join us next Sunday at 11 a.m. when host Rick Moore returns with another interesting guest. For The Wake Up Call, I'm Dan Gould. Thanks for listening. This has been the Sunday Morning Wake Up Call on Real Oldies 97.9 The Wren. The Wake Up Call is produced by Dan Gould. Show archives can be found at sevillepodcast.com. Be sure to join Rick next Sunday morning at 11 a.m. for The Wake Up Call, only on 97.9 The Wren.